Let me welcome Professor Michael O'Rourke. Professor O'Rourke is a professor for philosophy and faculty of the Ag Bio Research and Environmental Science and Policy at Michigan State University. He is director of the Toolbox Dialogue Initiative, which is an NSF-funded research initiative that investigates philosophical approaches to facilitate interdisciplinary research. And last but not least, he is interim director of the Michigan State University Center for Interdisciplinarity. He has worked on epistemology, philosophy of environmental science, communication and epistemic integration in collaborative cross-disciplinary research, and linguistic communication between intelligent agents. If I would try to give you a list of all the papers that he produced during the years and the awards that were granted to him, I would still be here in an hour. So let me just say that he is the perfect person for interdisciplinary research for more than one reason. Firstly, he has worked interdisciplinarily himself, mostly with environmental science and biology. And then he also worked about interdisciplinarity. And that is also the topic of his talk today. So let me very warmly welcome Michael O'Rourke, and I'm very much looking forward to your talk about interdisciplinarity, integration, and dialogue, reflections on the philosophy of interdisciplinarity.
Thank you very much for the very kind introduction, Dr. Antos. And thank you all for your applause. I'm very honored to be here. It's rare that I have an opportunity to stand in front of an audience that's this experienced with interdisciplinary work, and an audience that I think has really accomplished a great deal when it comes to interdisciplinarity. So this is a rare treat for me, and I'm very glad to have the opportunity. I also wanted to say just a word before I get into the talk about the Zukunftskolleg, which I have to admit, before I got the email invitation, I didn't really know that much about, but I've become a student of the Zukunftskolleg over the last few months. I had an opportunity to come in yesterday and hang out with the Scientific Advisory Board and learn a little bit more about the Zukunftskolleg, and also today's session provided me even more detail. It's a remarkably impressive effort, I have to say. I've been engaged in facilitating interdisciplinary research across the world for the last 15 years or so, having had the opportunity to spend time with over 250 different research groups. And there are a lot of things about this effort that are pretty distinctive and different in my experience, right? So I think it's brilliant to focus on early career researchers, so postdocs. I think that's exactly where focus should be, where one's focus should be. I also think that the idea of giving fellowships for 5 years is worth comment. It's something that I've not encountered. I have not seen anybody else do this. It's very innovative, and it has, in my opinion, has a couple of impacts. One, it allows a group like the Zukunftskolleg to really put their money where their mouth is when it comes to talking about building community. A lot of people talk about building community. But let's be honest, if you give a postdoc a 2-year fellowship, they're going to spend most of the time looking for the next job, right? I mean, especially that second year, they're going to be focused on getting the next job. You give them 5 years, then you really give them the opportunity to get to know one another and take chances, especially interdisciplinary chances. Because when you're a postdoc, you're supposed to become a star, right? You're supposed to become an expert in your discipline. And you're going to drill down into that discipline, especially when you have 2 years. Right? If you give 5 years, that really gives you the space to engage in meaningful interdisciplinary work. And that's exciting. And, you know, also it gives postdocs a chance to take risks. I think because of the need to become a star, postdocs can be risk-averse when it comes to interdisciplinarity. But 5 years, no, yeah, it gives you a little bit more time and space to take chances. And out of that comes research innovation. So this is, you know, it's a lot to be happy about. In my view, when it comes to this, to the Zukunftskolleg, and I'm very impressed. So, with that, I'll launch into my prepared remarks. So, yes, I know a little bit about interdisciplinarity. I've focused on it for the past couple of decades. What I'd like to do today is speak as a philosopher about interdisciplinarity. This is probably not necessary, given Dr. Antos' very generous introduction. But what I'd like to kind of emphasize is something that she also mentioned, that I'm a philosopher who thinks about interdisciplinarity, but I'm also an interdisciplinarian who approaches projects philosophically. Right? So, you know, it's kind of in the spirit of wherever you go, there you are. I'm a philosopher, so when I engage with interdisciplinary projects, when I think about interdisciplinarity, I bring a philosophical perspective, and that's what I'll try to do today. One of the things that you'll realize very quickly, especially by comparing my slides to Giovanni's slides, is the difference in cultures between presentations by, say, philosophers and neuroscientists, right? The philosophers' presentations tend to be very, very word-heavy. So I'm going to apologize for that in advance. Okay. All right, here's the plan. As I indicated in the title, I'll spend the next 50 minutes or so reflecting on interdisciplinarity. I'm going to begin with just a few thoughts about the philosophy of interdisciplinarity, and then on the heels of that, look at a couple of different topics. The first topic I want to spend some time with is the nature of interdisciplinarity. Right? So in true philosophical style, I'd like to do some conceptual analysis and walk away from the first part of the talk with perhaps a clearer vision of what might count as interdisciplinarity. We'll start by talking briefly about disciplines and their combination, and then I'm going to spend a sizable chunk of time talking about integration as the distinctive feature, a characteristic feature of interdisciplinarity. The second broad topic that I'd like to consider, once we have maybe a clearer vision of what counts as interdisciplinarity, is how can we be successful at it? What can we do to be successful interdisciplinarians? I want to move in the direction of an answer to that question through the topic of communication. Spending a bit of time talking about interdisciplinary communication before focusing in on dialogue, which is something that's very important to the Zukunftskolleg. And I'll close that part with the question of how dialogue can integrate before concluding. So that's the plan for my remarks. I'll start again with just a minute or two about the philosophy of interdisciplinarity. There are a lot of different philosophical projects that people engage in who are interested in interdisciplinarity, that philosophers engage in when they turn their attention to this particular topic. Most, if not all, of those efforts begin with a stage where interdisciplinarity is conceptualized, right? So you pause up front just to make sure you understand what you're talking about. And that's what I kind of like to focus on right now, and engage in a bit of philosophical reflection on interdisciplinarity, where by that I mean systematic identification of constituent concepts and relations. So the concepts and relations that figure importantly into the phenomenon of interdisciplinarity. Now, for me, philosophical reflection includes a number of things. First, modal analysis of concepts to determine application conditions. So, in other words, thinking about the concepts with a view to identifying conditions that must be satisfied by something in order for it to count as an instance of the concept. Thinking about conditions, satisfaction of which qualifies something as an instance of the concept. Or perhaps identifying conditions, the satisfaction of which is just a good indication that you're in the presence of something that qualifies as an instance of that concept. Right? So necessary conditions, sufficient conditions, and then, you know, conditions that are good indicators. I'm also interested in evaluating the normative dimensions of interdisciplinary activity. So in other words, identifying standards that we can use to distinguish better forms of interdisciplinary work from, you know, stronger forms from weaker forms of interdisciplinary activity. I also have an interest in mapping conceptual networks that support interdisciplinary reasoning. And finally, cultivating a synoptic view, a kind of overarching view of interdisciplinarity in context. It's important, in my view, to recognize that interdisciplinarity is never sort of floats free from the world. It's always embodied, it's always realized in a context. But if you start with that, it seems to me that you can still acquire a synoptic view of the phenomenon. From my perspective, and this is somewhat crude, you can distinguish two different kinds of synoptic views. There's what I'll call the critical view and the constructive view. Those philosophers who engage in critical interdisciplinarity are interested in the phenomenon as a social or political phenomenon. They see interdisciplinarity as primarily a political innovation. For example, there are those who would argue that interdisciplinarity must be understood as a reaction to disciplinary hegemony. So in other words, they want to suggest that the reason that people are so excited about interdisciplinarity is that organizing knowledge around disciplines, organizing institutions around disciplines, hasn't gotten us anywhere, has put us on the wrong track, has actually moved us farther away from solving problems that really matter to us. And that what we need to do is we need to replace that way of organizing knowledge with a different one. And so interdisciplinarity is served up then as a concept that supports the improvement or replacement of interdisciplinarity through the identification of its weaknesses and limitations. So that's a critical approach to interdisciplinarity. On the constructive side, you find those philosophers interested in understanding interdisciplinarity as an epistemic or knowledge-related phenomenon, right? That aims at a kind of complex understanding. So these philosophers are interested in sort of seeing interdisciplinarity as a mode of practice that puts us in a position to understand ourselves and our world better. Philosophers who work on this topic from a constructive perspective tend to see interdisciplinarity as a mode of intellectual activity that involves the interrelationship of multiple perspectives. You need to acquire some familiarity with those perspectives as well as with the mode of combination. And more generally, constructive approaches to interdisciplinarity are interested in approaching the topic as people participating in the broader project of explaining and understanding ourselves and our world. Right? So interdisciplinarity is a kind of phenomenon that people engage in, and as such, it's a part of the world we live in and deserving of explanation and understanding in those terms. What I'll do in the time that remains is adopt a constructive perspective on the topic. And I'd like to provide just a few reflections on the nature of interdisciplinarity, as well as a number of the concepts that I think figure importantly into it, those being integration, communication, and dialogue. So that's the plan. With that, I'll turn to the first question that I wanted to spend some time with. What is interdisciplinarity? I'm going to do a little bit of preliminary work to set up consideration of definition of this term. The first thing I'd like to point out, which is not news to anybody in this room, or probably anybody anywhere, that interdisciplinarity has some sort of compositional relationship with disciplines. Right? Disciplines figure importantly into this phenomenon. So if you want to understand what interdisciplinarity is, it's best that you start by making sense out of disciplines, just a little bit. I like to think of disciplines as an epistemic technology. Right? They're a socio-historical construction that has a number of virtues, virtues that I think are explanatory of the ascendancy of disciplines as a way of organizing knowledge. They're associated with a circumscribed but dynamic range of central questions. Also, a circumscribed but dynamic range of preferred methods, methods that are leveraged along with the prior knowledge to advance the frontiers of knowledge in that field. From a different angle, I'd like to suggest that academic or intellectual disciplines are also disciplines in a different sense, right? So the term discipline can be used sometimes to talk about, like what you acquire when you engage in a demanding regimen. So if you want to run a marathon, for instance, it's best that you go out and run a little bit ahead of time, right? So strengthen your body and your mind so that you're in a position to complete the distance that you need to complete when you run a marathon. That, what you're doing is you're disciplining yourself to be able to complete the course, right? And it's I think, appropriate to think of intellectual disciplines as involving that kind of discipline as well. Right? If you think about how you acquire your expertise, you typically start at some point with a general introduction to knowledge. Right? You learn about the range of different questions that are out there that people are interested in. And you then narrow your focus down, maybe to a major as an undergraduate. And then you go to graduate school, you narrow your focus down even more. Right? And along the way, what you're doing is you're acquiring a kind of discipline, requiring a kind of focus and strength, and sort of epistemic strength that puts you in a position to appreciate the importance of the questions that matter to that field, as well as deploy the methods that are going to enable you to answer those questions. Right? So that's the kind of intellectual discipline that you acquire when you engage in this type of work. And as I mentioned, disciplines are reflected in the organization of universities, as well as libraries and databases. My preferred specific conception of disciplines is this one: intrinsically constituted and maintained sets of knowledge practices that are sufficiently widespread and stable to receive institutional support. This highlights both an intrinsic dimension of disciplines and an extrinsic dimension of disciplines. So, seen intrinsically, you can understand disciplines as epistemic cultures, right? So cultures that arise around this distinctive set of questions and methods that put people in a position to develop new knowledge of a particular sort. From an extrinsic perspective, this way of thinking about disciplines helps us understand the knowledge market or the research market character of disciplines, right? If you're a part of a discipline, you go to conferences. You know, if you're part of a discipline, you might be a part of a department and you search for new faculty members, or you train people to be faculty members down the road, right? You're involved, arguably, in something that looks like a market, creating new experts to fill roles that might be vacated when you retire. Now, are disciplines inevitable? Disciplines are the way we tend to organize knowledge. And if you work, like I do, in an academic institution, it might seem like this is just the natural way of organizing knowledge. And there are aspects of this type of career that reinforce that. Academic research culture rewards specialization. It's incentivized in the academy. Specialists tend to talk to one another. They go to conferences where they give talks to one another, they give critiques to one another, and that generates the sort of impression that the knowledge that you've produced is really just for your peers, right? I mean, sometimes people, like if you're, you know, taking a plane trip somewhere and you happen to sit down to someone who's talkative and won't just let you work, and they ask you what you do and you talk to them and they may not appreciate the importance of the research that you've done. So I don't know if that's ever happened to you. It's like, you know, you sort of kind of come away from those experiences thinking, look, it's like this is what I'm doing is best understood by the people I talk to when I go to my conferences, right? But what I think what this sort of culture generates is a kind of echo chamber effect, right? Where we tend to be really impressed by the research that we conduct within our discipline, and really impressed by the degree to which our colleagues appreciate our research, and we can be challenged, I think, to imagine new ways or different ways of organizing knowledge, right? So this is sort of makes it seem like discipline is a natural kind or something like that. But I think this group especially appreciates the fact that complex problems, they don't have any respect for disciplines. And career trajectories, they don't have any respect, or at least for a lot of people. I certainly number myself among these. Educational and career trajectories don't respect disciplinary lines either, right? Those two points there serve as, sort of explanations for why we pursue interdisciplinarity, right? They're answers to the question, where does interdisciplinarity come from? Another source that's worth taking a look at if you're interested in this topic, the monograph Facilitating Interdisciplinary Research, which was produced in 2004 by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, identified four drivers of interdisciplinarity. These drivers overlap with the pair of motivations I just gave you, those being the inherent complexity of nature and society and the desire to explore problems and questions that extend beyond a single discipline. In addition, there's a need to solve societal problems and the power of new technologies. The National Academy saw these four motivations as motivations that are really behind our interest in growing interdisciplinary research and becoming better at conducting interdisciplinary research. All right, so with those as some background thoughts about interdisciplinarity, how it relates, you know, what disciplines are as its primary constituent, and, you know, maybe a little bit about the motivation for caring about this, we can now turn our attention to definitional matters. The first thing to do maybe is to start by emphasizing once again disciplines as the unit of analysis for the purpose of understanding this. And here, take the term discipline and, you know, attach to it this prefix inter, right, which suggests something like between or across or mutuality or reciprocity. And what we get is a suggestion that interdisciplinary or interdiscipline is implies mutuality or reciprocity between or among disciplines. So interaction is a good comparison here. So interaction involves the reciprocity or mutuality between actors. Now, if you buy this as a way of at least kind of initially glossing the term interdisciplinarity, what you get, I think, is the entailment of combination or exchange, right? That disciplines which figure into an interdisciplinary activity are become related to one another in a way that that looks a lot like mutual dependence, right? So they don't function independently in the context of an interdisciplinary activity. The kind of deliberation and decision making that the representative of discipline A will engage in that context will be inflected and informed by the deliberation and decision making of the person who represents discipline B, and vice versa. Right, so there's a sort of mutual dependence that arises in this context, which I think is distinctive of interdisciplinary activity. Now, this mutual dependence, one way to think about it is ecologically. Right? So if you think of an interdisciplinary project as a kind of epistemic ecosystem, right, where you have organic elements, people, in this case, who represent disciplines, that function in relation to one another to create a larger system. One thing that I think is useful about using this analogy is that, you know, elements of ecosystems can affect one another indirectly, right? You don't need to be in constant contact with something in order for that thing and its activities to affect you. And the same is true in interdisciplinary projects, right? That there might be more or less direct relationships between partners in a big interdisciplinary collaboration. That doesn't mean that just because there's not direct relationships that there isn't dependence. So what I'd like to suggest as an initial sort of gloss on interdisciplinarity is that mutual dependence is critical. Now, mutual dependence can be used to help us distinguish interdisciplinarity from a couple of constructs that it's typically distinguished from in the literature: multidisciplinarity and transdisciplinarity. So if we take interdisciplinarity to be composed of disciplines, we can distinguish interdisciplinarity from multidisciplinarity and transdisciplinarity. They kind of form a dimension or a spectrum that is graded in terms of increasing mutual dependence. Right? So if the least mutually dependent combinations of disciplines qualify as multidisciplinary, and the most qualify as transdisciplinary, and the interdisciplinarity occupies the middle ground somewhere. Now, for those of you who are familiar with the term transdisciplinary, the way that I'm using it here is slightly different from the dominant way in which it's used in Europe. Typically in Europe, it's used to signal the involvement of non-academic partners in research projects. And here, what I'm doing is sort of borrowing an employment of the term that's common in the United States. Typically, it just sort of derives from work in the science of team science. Understanding transdisciplinary as transformative interdisciplinarity. So you see these as graded along a particular spectrum. Okay.
Can you explain what TD means?
Sure. Well, so there are a couple of different conceptions, right? So there's this European conception where transdisciplinarity involves complex research activity that involves non-academic partners, typically community members or other stakeholders who might be invited in to participate in a project without having academic credentials, right? So these are projects that, often aim to improve situations outside of the lab, so to speak. But there's a contrasting sense of transdisciplinarity that, again, involves like a deep and transformative integration of disciplinary inputs. So for those who use the term that way, what they're really looking at are situations in which disciplines come together and maybe change by virtue of the combination and form some new discipline. Maybe some new discipline emerges from the from that kind of transformative process. Right, and that's it's that latter sense of transdisciplinarity that I'm most interested in here. Does that help?
Okay.
I think the term is ambiguous in the literature, and
basically it means involving practical aspects with people dealing with practical aspects.
Sure. That's one interpretation, right? And there are others that it's the other one that I'm kind of leveraging for this purpose. This is like the work of Dan Stokols and others that funded by the National Cancer Institute in the U.S. and that's responsible for the development of the science of team science. They tend to use the term this way, which is not very helpful, honestly. But okay, so here's a definition to chew on. This is from the National Academy of Sciences report facilitating interdisciplinary research. So I'll just kind of read through this. Interdisciplinary research is a mode of research by teams or individuals that integrates information, data, techniques, and so forth from two or more disciplines or bodies of specialized knowledge. So here they sort of emphasizing disciplines as inputs to advance fundamental understanding or solve problems whose solutions are beyond the scope of a single discipline or area of research practice. So what's interesting about this is that it kind of highlights the teleological, right, nature or goal-oriented nature of transdisciplinary or interdisciplinary research. So in this case, it's emphasizing the fact that we don't typically do interdisciplinary research just for its own sake. We tend to be motivated by some kind of special question or complex problem to engage in this type of work. What I'd like to focus on is this term, integrates. So integrates, what I want to suggest, is the term that's doing the work of introducing mutual dependence into this definition. Okay. So integration as a construct is used by many in the literature on interdisciplinarity to highlight what's special about interdisciplinary activity. Let's see. And because of the suggestion that you can make sense out of interdisciplinarity in terms of integration, it's important to make sense out of what integration amounts to. The first thing to note, if we just return to our diagram from a few slides ago, is that if you're inclined, as the National Academies are, to define interdisciplinarity in terms of integration, what you're doing is you're replacing mutual dependence, right, this sort of graded construct here, with integration. Oops. So that you go from the less integrated combinations of disciplines to the most integrated combinations of disciplines. And that's integration is supposed to do the work of representing mutual dependence. Well, the next thing maybe is to pause for a moment and to consider how we might think of integration. Here's a definition from Alan Repko. He's an important contributor to interdisciplinary studies. He sees integration as a process by which ideas, data, and information, and so forth, from two or more disciplines are synthesized, connected, or blended. Right? So he takes integration, as he understands it in the context of that particular book, to be a phenomenon or some sort of a relation that manifests within an interdisciplinary context. And in addition, he highlights what he takes to be the initial conditions of integration in an interdisciplinary context, which require for him conflict, controversy, and difference. Right? So we should pause here for a second. You might wonder how helpful this definition is. If you wonder that, you're not alone. Integration here is defined in terms of synthesis, which might strike you as somewhat circular. We'll set that aside for a second. Another point to make is that he uses a metaphor, really, to help us understand what integration amounts to. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it doesn't sort of induce the kind of precision that one might hope to get in a definition of a key concept like integration. I'd like to try to move a little bit beyond this in the next few slides. Integration, as I mentioned, is a very typical way of unpacking what mutual dependence looks like for interdisciplinarity. But it's not without its critics. So Britt Holbrook, in an important recent paper, distinguishes integration and the integrative, what he calls the Habermas-Klein approach, from a couple of competing approaches. The Kuhn-McIntyre approach, which involves seeing interdisciplinarity as involving essentially a kind of incommensurability between disciplines, and that real interdisciplinary success depends upon people not integrating, but becoming fluent in more than one disciplinary language. The second contrasting approach is what he calls the Bataille-Lyotard approach. And here, the special feature of successful interdisciplinarity involves the generation of a new language, a new genre of discourse that emerges from breaking down the conflicting languages that are brought to the interdisciplinary context by this specific disciplines involved. For him, neither of these is integrative. Lisa Latica argues that integration is problematic because it's hard to quantify and measure, so we should set it aside, pay attention to the initial conditions within which interdisciplinarity arises, focus on the kinds of questions that motivate interdisciplinary responses. And for her, again, that's not integrative. A third set of critics, Barry and co-authors, contrast the integrative or synthesis mode with the subordinate service mode, according to which disciplines can get together in combination with a master discipline and some subordinates, and the agonistic-antagonistic mode, where the aim is to transcend disciplinary differences. Now, I would suggest that Holbrook and Latica, in particular, are critics of interdisciplinarity. From them, critics of integration. They're inclined to see integration as somehow bankrupt and a kind of concept that doesn't really help us understand what interdisciplinary activity is. They want to replace it. Barry and colleagues see integration as helpful but local, right? Not the sort of thing that's going to provide us with a comprehensive understanding. It's important, though, in reviewing this literature to pay attention to what their targets are. Most of the critiques that are put forward in this literature understand integration in a pretty robust way, right? If you go back to the Repko definition, for Repko, integration requires this conflict, right, or difference, like manifest difference at the beginning in order for integration to take root. He also talks about processes that look more like blending, right? So blending suggests a very deep kind of connection that is created between the constituent disciplines. And then outputs for Repko need to be more comprehensive in their treatment of the questions that motivated the integration in the first place. So there are a lot of preconditions that have to be satisfied by a particular interdisciplinary context for integration of the sort that he envisions to take place. I'm going to suggest that we call this thick integration and contrast it with a more thin or ecumenical conception of integration. And here what I'm going to suggest is that we take mutual dependence to be just understood as a category of relations, and if we understand it relationally without imposing a whole lot of preconditions on the implementation of integration, what we might find is a conception of integration that that does the job of underwriting how we understand interdisciplinary activity to function without, you know, becoming exposed to the types of critiques that Holbrook, Latica, and Barry and colleagues have put forward. Here's a picture of a model of integration that I favor. Here, this is a pretty simple input-process-output or IPO model of integration. You can look at integration as a process, and that makes sense to me. You can also think about integration in terms of the products, right? Are they integrated products? And you can also think about integration from the perspective of the inputs. So this type of approach provides you with resources to make sense out of integration wherever you might find it in an interdisciplinary context. This also comes with some more global constraints, these at the bottom, that bear typically on integration where you find it. One of the virtues of this approach is that you pull it, it pulls integration as a concept out of the interdisciplinary context in particular. This is sort of put forward as a more general model of integration, one that does justice to the kinds of integration we might find, for instance, in perception. In perception, where we have new visual percepts that are integrated into our consciousness along with percepts that come from other sensory modalities. It does justice, in my view, to integration as we find it in the philosophy of science. There's quite a lot of work in philosophy of biology, for instance, on integration. This model reaches out beyond interdisciplinary contexts to accommodate those other ways of thinking about integration. Now, the key thing to this is this this idea of an integrative relation. And here's just an example of some kind of pairwise relations that you might think of as, to some extent, integrative. Conservation here is sort of the null. It's the contrast. This is not integrative. The rest, it seems to me, are integrative, or you can at least make an argument for annihilation as an integrative relation. But you'll notice that some of these, like combinations and serialization, don't really require that much has to happen to the disciplinary inputs for there to be integration as a part of the process. So what this does is it distances itself from the thicker conceptions of integration and allows us to understand interdisciplinarity as involving mutual dependence in a variety of forms. So mutual dependence can be manifest in a context and so qualify a particular type of activity as interdisciplinary, even if the disciplinary inputs are left more or less intact. With this in hand, this way of thinking about integration in hand, we can go back to the National Academy's definition and kind of argue, I think, that if we understand it relationally, integration will allow us to characterize interdisciplinarity much more broadly than many other competing conceptions of integration will afford in the literature. So it does create, I mean, basically it's an expansive conception of interdisciplinarity in terms of a relational notion of integration that might allow for quite a number of things to qualify as interdisciplinarity that might, for, at least from the thicker perspectives, not qualify. And I can talk in detail about that in question and answer if you'd like. All right, the second topic that I'm interested in is how, if we understand interdisciplinarity this way, how can we do it well? Well, success in interdisciplinary activity understood this way depends upon bringing inputs into mutual dependence in a way that's required by project objectives. All right. This is a necessary condition, not a sufficient one, largely because you can do your best work, bring them into mutual dependence, and the world can change out from under you, and you're, you know, left without success. You know, things happen. It's also a net constraint over the life of a project. It's not the case that one need always be, you know, increasing mutual dependence in order to be doing interdisciplinary work. And in fact, it seems to me that when you engage in this kind of work, sometimes you need to disintegrate before you integrate, right? I don't know if you folks have ever been to IKEA. I've found myself being forced to disintegrate quite often when dealing with IKEA furniture before reintegrating. So that, I mean, that's an example of the kind of thing that you need to be prepared to do when you're engaging in interdisciplinary activity. It's not always full speed ahead, right, from unintegrated to maximally integrated. Right? Oops. Okay. So what does it take to be successful? Here's a long list of considerations that I think are important, from leadership to the personalities of collaborators, the relative locations of the collaborators, and so forth. What I'd like to focus on is communication. I take communication to be a central consideration for success within interdisciplinary projects. In fact, what I'd like to suggest is that this long list here is, from an important perspective, a long list of communication-related features of interdisciplinary activity. And so this particular view of the centrality of communication is shared by the National Academies report. Right? They see it as the heart of interdisciplinarity. And those of you who have engaged in this work, all of us in this room, appreciate how challenging communication can be when you're conducting interdisciplinary work, right? When an interdisciplinary research project. So again, to the philosophical thing, spending a little time doing semantics. If we understand communication as making common, we could think of communication in this context as the co-construction of meaning and pursuit of a goal. So when you engage in a communication episode with a partner, what you're doing, arguably, is in producing meaning collaboratively in pursuit of a goal. That goal may not be, you know, that goal may be something as thin as just entertaining yourself, for instance, passing the time, right? But typically, this is, I think this is a reasonably general way of thinking about what counts as communication. And a few comments about the bits and pieces of this definition. This definition highlights communication as a construction process, so that it involves joint interpretation of interpersonal interactions. That's collaborative. That requires a certain degree of responsiveness and mutuality among the conversation partners. Meaning is the thing that's exchanged and negotiated and compromised. And it also highlights the fact that communication is typically instrumental in its use. We're typically communicating with the view to accomplishing some purpose. Now, communication, so understood, admits of some analysis. There are a couple important dimensions that I think it's useful to highlight, especially when you're thinking about communication in interdisciplinary environments. The first is the informational dimension. Right, so information communication typically involves the transaction of information. This focuses on creating and sharing problem-related information that produces collective knowledge. It's the cognitive dimension of communication. And in an interdisciplinary context, what you find along the informational dimension includes things like the technical vernaculars, or the jargon of particular disciplines. The informational modes, some disciplines are about empirical evidence, some disciplines are more theoretical. The formal rigor that in many disciplines has to attach to the information that's put forward in order for that information to be taken seriously. And then also task-focused considerations. On the relational side, we can think of this dimension in this way, as involving the interactions that create the social fabric of a group by promoting relationships between and among members. Right? So this is from Joanne Keaton. I think it highlights how, you know, if you think about it, when we communicate with other people, we're communicating with people, as people. And the relational dimensions of these interactions are critically important. This is the affective or expressive dimension, and arguably it's perhaps even more important than the informational dimension when it comes to interdisciplinary work. Right? We can't do interdisciplinarity at a high level unless we have norms for communication, unless we trust one another. One of the things that you need to be able to do if you're going to be successful at interdisciplinary work is you need to be able to defer. You need to be able, so if it's a collaborative project, you need to be able to recognize that when you're not the expert, and you need to defer to your collaborator. That's not something we're trained to do. Along the way to becoming an expert, we're not trained to defer, right? We're encouraged not to defer. So interdisciplinary activity puts you in position to communicate in ways that might not be very comfortable. All right, so that's an analysis of communication understood as co-construction of meaning and pursuit of a goal. There are special challenges forthcoming for communicators who participate in interdisciplinary projects. One thing that I spent quite a bit of time in my role as director of the Toolbox Dialogue Initiative thinking about is what can be done to enable collaborators to surmount differences in research worldview. Right? We're trained in our disciplines to look at the world in a particular way, right? To have certain kinds of questions and issues be foregrounded for us and other kinds of questions and issues backgrounded. And, you know, it so happens that if you're working with a collaborator from another discipline, they're going to see the common problem differently than you do, right? There's certain things that are going to stand out for them that don't stand out for you, right? And if you're not prepared to function in a collaborative way in an interdisciplinary context, you might not appreciate what their perspective on the problem could contribute, right? So figuring out how to move past unreasonable agreement, unreasonable disagreement, in the context of a collaborative project is a crucially important part of interdisciplinary communication that's often underappreciated, right? At least by those who think, who do theoretical work on interdisciplinarity. Now, when it works well, what interdisciplinary communication can provide is reflexivity. So it can put collaborators in a position to be reflective about their own communication practices when those are functional, and when those actually might limit one's interaction with collaborators. And it can also enable collaborators to adopt the perspectives, the each other's perspectives, so to see the research landscape through each other's eyes, right? Good interdisciplinary communication should support reflexivity and perspective taking. But it's important not to be naive, right? I mean, we've all engaged in this work, and communication fails more than it succeeds, I'd submit, in many interdisciplinary contexts. Co-construction of meaning needn't be integrative, right? If the situation in a particular context involves a power gradient that puts certain people in charge and other people, are left without a voice, then, there can be talking back and forth without that talking ever really truly involving co-construction. Right, and there can also be times when people just defer without really contributing, without thinking about it. Those are examples of situations in which communication fails. Some communication modalities, it seems to me, are better placed to contribute to meaningful communication in interdisciplinary contexts. And dialogue is the one that I'm going to end by talking about. So I see dialogue as a particular type of communication modality that has special importance for interdisciplinary practitioners. Once again, how do we understand the concept of dialogue? We can start with its etymology. From the Greek, it can be understood as converse with or speak through. These, I would submit, actually point in different directions, slightly different directions, for how we might interpret dialogue. Different directions are actually kind of useful in thinking through the literature that exists on this topic. There's a conceptually thin way of unpacking it that I think corresponds to the converse with conception. Here, there are those who want to see dialogue as simply just not monologue, right? So any kind of dialogue is a conversational episode or communication episode in which there's more than one speaker. Sometimes people go a little bit farther and induce some structure into that, so they require that there be turn-taking, right? But the turn-taking doesn't actually have to be all that integrative, right? The turn-taking you can have what amounts to kind of serial monologuing, right? Or like the conversational equivalent of like toddler parallel play, right? Where they're sort of, it looks from the outside like they're maybe engaged in dialogue, but they're actually just doing their own thing, doing their own thing within earshot of each other, right? That's permitted on this way of thinking about dialogue. Thicker conceptions require that there be more connection between the speaking turns, between the contributions to the conversational episode that the speakers make. There are a number of ways to make out this thicker conception. Some highlight the presence of conflict or tension between interlocutors, between the conversational partners. The tension needn't be negative, right? So I had a student, I don't dance. I'm lousy at it. I have a student who dances. She's partner dancing, and she highlighted the idea of tension here in a way that I thought was really illuminating. Right, that if you dance with a partner, you have to be responsive to differences in tension, right? In order to be, you know, when to push and when to pull, in order to be able to dance effectively together, right? That's the kind of responsiveness to tension that I would submit is critically important to dialogue, right? A crucial part of dialogical interaction. Dialogue typically involves cooperation, even reciprocity between listeners and speakers, right? So a kind of mutual dependence on one another in the course of the dialogical exchange. It's useful in thinking about dialogue to pay some attention to listeners. Listeners often get left out of the equation when we think about communication. We tend to focus on speakers and what speakers have to say. Speakers sort of, you know, to continue with the dancing analogy, kind of speakers dance the lead, right? So we tend to think about them. But it's important in characterizing dialogue to spend some time thinking about listeners as well. Dialogue is marked by increased back-channel signaling. So increased signaling from the listener to the speaker that their contributions are being taken up, right? Or perhaps not being taken up. And that points to another way of thinking about how listeners and speakers might be related in dialogue, a kind of counterfactual dependence that you might characterize as sort of critical readiness to respond, right? You're poised as a dialogue partner to respond to your interlocutor. If they say something maybe that you don't agree with, you'll jump in. If they say something you agree with, you might elaborate, right? So there's a kind of Habermasian-like sort of critical readiness that features importantly into how we think about dialogue. And finally, a commitment to understanding. Together, these could be understood in a deeper and more systematic analysis, which I don't have time to provide, as constituting a number of constraints on dialogue: semantic, pragmatic, structural, epistemic. I like this thicker conception of dialogue. I think it works as an answer. It works to kind of highlight why dialogue's special, especially for interdisciplinarians. This is a quote from Bakhtin. He's talking about the novel, discourse in the novel. But I think what he says about dialogue there works just as well in the interdisciplinary context. Dialogue can reveal mutual non-understanding among people who speak different languages, right? Disciplinary languages in this case. It can also support mutual interanimation and illumination that brings interdisciplinary partners together, that enables them to knit together their different views in dynamic joint construal. This borrows from Bakhtin and from Herb Clark, a psycholinguist. And finally, again, Bakhtin highlights the dialogue as a kind of conversational mode that where interlocutors are in a mutually entangled state, that where that mutual entanglement supports the achievement of certain kinds of epistemic products, collective knowledge or understanding about one's topic. So understood, it seems to me that the dialogue is integratively quite powerful. It can support co-creation of an interpretation, working together in a joint communicative action to build meaning. It can also support respectful creation and maintenance of common ground, which is not to say that dialogue always has to be happy and fun, right? Sometimes dialogue is, you know, unpleasant, right? But what's required in order for dialogue to be successful is that the centrifugal and the centripetal forces are balanced, right? Those forces that make you fly apart, make you want to run away, are held kind of in check by your reasons for being there. Maybe the joint purposes that you really care about and you want to solve together. All right. And the toolbox workshops that I mentioned and that Carolyn mentioned, we've done a number of these. They involve structured dialogue designed to enable collaborators to communicate more effectively with one another. Okay, I'm going to end very quickly with two problems, two examples. These are examples perhaps that only a philosopher could love since they're still pretty abstract. but I can go into more detail if you want in question and answer. I'm going to go back to those two notions that I introduced before of unreasonable disagreement and unreasonable agreement. You can think of unreasonable disagreement as a kind of disagreement between collaborators about a claim where at least one is unreasonable in holding it, holding the attitude that they hold. Right? This could be rooted in misunderstanding. At least one position is not supported adequately by evidence. And here, instead of a committed position, perhaps a more neutral epistemic position is appropriate. Right? So instead of disagreeing with one another unreasonably, you should sort of stand back and withhold until you have more evidence. Right? So this is an example of kind of at a higher level of what an unreasonable disagreement might look like. Unreasonable agreement actually is rooted in the same things: misunderstanding, lack of evidence, and adopting an inappropriate epistemic position. Unreasonable agreement involves two people agreeing when they really shouldn't be. Right? This is actually, in my view, the more insidious of the two, especially for interdisciplinary activity. Right? If we're collaborating with somebody, we want to agree with them. Right? We want this to work. And we will, I think sometimes ignore signals of difference and embrace agreement even when we're not warranted in doing so. In those situations, you agree unreasonably. Now, dialogical solutions to these look kind of like this. A dialogue can help to reveal when disagreement is unreasonable by putting people in a position to lay out their case for why they hold the view that they hold, right? This can introduce additional dimensions that allow people to see that perhaps what they were taking to be a conflict wasn't really a conflict at all. I have a collaborator who likes to use this image of if you look at two things going like this from the top, it might look like they're on a collision course, but then if you add an additional dimension, you see, no, in fact, they're not on a collision course, right? So what might look like a disagreement from here turns out not to be a disagreement if you add an additional dimension. And dialogue has the power to do that. It has the power to put you in a position to appreciate the complexity of these kinds of situations. So it's a bad picture that's intended to kind of do this. You can see why I opt for words over pictures in my slides. Unreasonable agreement. Here, dialogue can disintegrate and then reintegrate. So this is an example of a situation where disintegration is a critically important part of interdisciplinary activity. That once you identify that you're unreasonably agreeing, you can then work toward establishing a more reasonable type of agreement on the backside. So here, you all sort of see yourselves as agreeing. You realize through dialogue that, no, in fact, the way you use the word sustainability is not the way I use the word sustainability. And in fact, when you say what you say, you're saying something that I really actually don't agree with. So this gets pulled apart. But then, it could at that point become an untenable situation where you say, well, that's not good. I'm just going to leave. Chances are, though, especially if you have a 5-year grant and you're in year 2, you might want to stick around and try to make it work. And that can result in the creation of a more complex understanding. All right, I'm done. So here are just a few takeaways. Almost. And I appreciate that. Look, if all it took was to get me to stop was to clap, you might have clapped 20 minutes ago. So I don't know. Okay, so first of all, philosophy of interdisciplinarity can be critical or constructive or both. Interdisciplinary research can be generally conceived as integrative if you understand that in this thin way, relationally in terms of mutual dependence. Interdisciplinary communication involves goal-oriented co-construction of meaning that is both informational and relational at the same time. And finally, dialogue, I'd submit, is a conversational modality that has special power for interdisciplinary projects. Power that, among other things, can move you from unreasonable states of agreement and disagreement to reasonable states. Thanks.